I've just been on the latest generation of 3D headsets. I don't know if anyone's been on them. They are mind-blowing. Stick your nan in them. It's amazing watching your grandma like, choke on her words as an alien comes towards her. It's going to impregnate me. Grandma. And But I think you could wear this and then sort of design in the virtual 3D world and then use 3D printers. So although you're not physically manipulating objects, it's an analogous experience because you're in the 3D mass manipulating virtual objects. Therefore, arguably, you could work with more physical objects than you could in the physical world. Stuff that no longer exists, or stuff that's endangered, or stuff that would be dangerous, or the one from the group of metals that when you throw them in the water explodes. I can't remember the one underneath lithium. And so you could get the big one and just...
I love the way you know that, though. You know the one, just under lithium, just to the left.
Which one is it? Yeah. Goes all the way down the grid. Which is the one that really goes off, where it writes a proper row?
It's a potassium.
Potassium, underneath that. Potassium, I'd have potassium all day long. I'd stick it in my drink. There's one underneath it. A proper nutter. Cesium, that's it. Absolute nutter. So... you could, but imagine I could put on my virtual reality mask and I could throw cesium into a lake and I could do that experiment, which I'm never going to do in real life. You can watch some YouTube clip, but you could have a more immersive scientific experience, and that would square the circle of doing the physical with the non-physical. I rest my case. Well,
thank you. By the way, Radio 4 does not encourage you to play cesium in a lake. I think we should make that very clear.
I can't get it. I searched everywhere. It's so annoying.
I want to talk about bubbles.
Well, we've both got a robot orchestra and a bottle of lemonade and some raisins, which is the biggest budget we've ever had on this show. And so we should kind of return to some of the ideas of actually what around the house people can... So if you are listening now and you have... This should be going out in mid-January, so you should still have some dried fruit left over that you didn't use. And hopefully one bottle of lemonade. This is all you require, and now I hand over to you, Helen.
So I've got a bottle of lemonade. I've taken the label off, so two litre bottle. And I'm going... This is terrifying, because if I don't want to spray all the people next to me with lemonade. Okay, so I've taken the lid off. And this is something that's really good to do. If you are bored at a party, and you either want to encourage the interesting people to come to you or have an excuse to leave, it works for both.
Ladies,
so I'm going to put the raisins in the lemonade in the top. There's a small handful of them, and the people who are near me will be able to see what's going on, which is that they're dancing. The raisins, they sink to the bottom and they sit there for a bit, and then they grow bubbles because bubbles, there's lots of dissolved gas in the lemonade. But in order to come out of solution, it needs a place to start, and a wrinkle in a bubble is an excellent thing for that on a raisin. So the raisins sink to the bottom, they grow themselves a little jacket of bubbles, and then overall the raisin is less dense than the fluid around it. Gravity is pointing downwards, and so the raisins rise to the top, and then they turn over until they get rid of all the bubbles, and then they sink back down again. And if you want a cheap lava lamp, this will keep going for about half an hour. After that, what you have does look a bit like a bottle of urine with dead flies at the bottom, but up till that point, it's awesome. And the thing here is, this is a buoyancy-driven flow, so whatever is more dense will tend to sink in the direction of gravity, which is downwards. Less dense things will rise to the top. And the analogy here, so these raisins at the top are pretty much doing exactly what happened to the Titanic to go from the quite nice to the quite seriously nasty. The little bubbles are like the air-filled spaces in the bottom of the Titanic that were keeping it buoyant because they were making the ship displace more water than its weight. And when those bubbles pop, the raisin sinks back down. And it just so happens that the size of a raisin relative to the depth of the lemonade bottle is almost exactly the size of the Titanic relative to the ocean it sank in, which is just a useful thing to know. But this buoyancy thing, it's not, you know, you can play this game with the raisins, but this is happening all the time. This kind of thing is driving our weather. Convective flows, buoyancy-driven flows are driving our weather and our oceans. So you can see a lot. And it's also, it's good for keeping people quiet. They're all just watching.
This is, we were talking about the analog world, the digital world. This is ultra-analog television for the listeners here. Because what you have to do is you listen to us, but you have to build what we're seeing. But you can do it. It is interesting. It's literally a 2 litre bottle of lemonade, drop some raisins in, you see this complex behaviour. And there are loads of bubbles in there. So, and I know that you We were just talking about what gets people into science and engineering. I know that have now become quite obsessed with bubbles.
It is my job.
Does it have a name? Have you christened it like bubble? Not bubbleology, but...
No, bubble physicist is a real job.
Now, Russell, if you'd like to explain exactly what Helen's face looked like as she said that to you.
I wanted a posh, long-sounding word. I could go, yes, I met Helen, she was a bubbleologist or something like that.
And Danielle, I can see that you like engineering, because have you got 16 floppy disk drives?
Yes.
For our younger listeners, do you want to explain what a floppy disk drive is?
Yeah.
And then say why you sat there with 16 of them in front of you.
So floppy drives are what used to be in computers. And they could hold 1.44 megabytes of data.
I remember that when I first got one of those in my computer. It was in the 1990s, wasn't it? 1.4 megabytes?
Yes.
That's less than one song, isn't it? It's an MP3.
Less.
Significantly less, actually.
It's one picture, isn't it? It's like one picture, one JPEG.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
with
tiny,
rubbish camera.
But at the time, that's all we needed.
Yeah.
So, but of course they're obsolete now, so what do you do with them? So a student from Cardiff University, he designed this for us, and it's floppy drive motors moving and creating music. So I'm going to play it. So they've got an electronic brain that brings them all together.
I should say that it's quite an array, because floppy disk drives are quite big, I suppose. What about the size of a CD? Oh, even a CD, I suppose. I mean, what's that?
Yeah, old man.
How can you describe how big? What are the measurements?
Like two Betamax next to each other.
Two Betamax. Yeah. That's what I was looking for. But it's quite a big array.
Yeah. So what you're going to hear is just literally the motors, these 20-plus-year-old motors moving and creating music. So I'm going to play some music and see if you know what it is.
That's remarkable.
It's incredible, isn't it, that technology can now be the equivalent of one man with a kazoo. It's remarkable things. But it is still, it's a breath. Have you got any other tunes on it?
I've got loads, yeah.
Let's just do that whole show. Cancel everything else we've done. Right, everyone get involved.
Here we go. This is Donald Trump's signature tune.
It also looks like the most
Donald
Trump.
So you've got that was, is that Vader's March? Is it called Vader's March? Actually,
Imperial
March.
So what that's actually doing is changing the speed of the motors.
It is, yeah. So what James, the student who did this, did was, so there's 16 of them, and there's a range, a physical range that the motors can move, and depending how far it moves, it will play a different note.
Oh, what you're hearing is the speed of rotation of the motor change,
yes, exactly.
Because of the position, because that's how the floppy disk drive works.
That's right, yeah. So you're seeing the motors physically moving, and that's what you can hear.
Because it's rotating.
What
do you think Michael Faraday would have made of this use of his invention?
Can it play Things Can Only Get Better? Or is it not one of the, not within its range? We've nearly run out of time.
We have, yes.
But we didn't ask the first question today, which was when exactly do we see experimental physics end up in the home, which distracted.
No, I think it's that idea about the frontier research now. So it didn't take long, I suppose, for transistors, for valves and then transistors to make their way into the home. It was extremely fast. So what are the things that we're learning now, do you think, to speculate that you might see in 10, 20, 30 years' time?
Familiar things, I think, will be a lot of sort of mobile technology and medical applications. So sort of before going to the doctors, you could check your cholesterol level, you can check your blood, you can check this, that and the other. Sort of diagnostics, early diagnostics for medical care. So what people are working on now is putting sort of wearable tech. There's a lot of wearable tech going on now. And so putting wearable technology into a lady's bra that will detect very, very early signs of cancer. So very, very early signs. So it's not meant to to be instead of going to the doctor and having a full checkup. But it literally, very early signs, because all you're looking for is a temperature difference, because a tumour is a different temperature to the skin. And then your mobile or a watch or whatever it is could then say, there's something a little bit funny here. I think you should go to the doctors.
I suppose the idea of building sensors into clothing and then finding easy diagnostic signals.
Yeah.
So what would you like to see in terms of in your house, what do you feel at the moment this is what you're hoping science is working on?
I like the idea of having a magic glove that can do my bidding in the home. So I can just be like, put the kettle on it, be like, indeed, sire.
Why would you just not sort of have a butler or something? Why do you want just a hand?
Yeah. It is more fun though, isn't it?
It would be like, the robot butler hand. That's it. That's why we call it Handrew. Handrew the robot butler. He would just do my bidding, sire, like with a little bow tie across the index finger. And it would obviously have drone technology so it could take off and then go about. The thing about a robot butler, I don't want, like, turn around and a full metal geezer staring at me going, anything else? And he's like, please get out, I find that creepy. Whereas a hand can't watch you while you're going about your business.
So, Helen, I don't know if you're going to up the ante from a disembodied hand being the thing that science has lacked so far. What would you like, Daniel? What are we seeing? What are we going to be expecting in the next decade?
I'd like a transparent kitchen. I want to be able to see inside my toaster and my kettle and my washing machine. I want to see what the bits are doing. And I think we could almost get to the stage. Someone does sell a transparent toaster for a horrendous amount of money. But that sort of thing, so you can actually see that things are happening. So that's what I would like to have. When it comes to technology, the problem is we're making it all invisible. That's why I want some things to be visible, because everything else is just going to disappear into the... And that's one of the difficult things when you talk about electricity, because the measure of our success with electricity is basically that we have no idea it's there. It is running the modern world, and yet we can't see it. You occasionally get an electric shock. So I think the technology will become invisible, and as a resistance to that, I want all the things that can still be visible to be even more visible.
I think that's a brilliant idea. I'm surprised no one's made a completely transparent washing machine or something like that, because it would be a really cool thing.
Different coloured bits and different coloured wires and things on the inside.
Now we've got the audience. We've asked them a question, and normally we make it kind of clear on the piece of paper that it's meant to be a light question, but we forgot to do that. So the punchlines are sometimes more specific than you might imagine to this. What scientific innovation would you like in your house and why? Wireless electrical to make sure that the number of wire-related fatalities was lower.
Boom.
Instant medical diagnosis. That would reduce NHS waiting times.
Boom. Boom, boom, boom.
This is more like it. A portable black hole for waste disposal. That's a brilliant idea, because it would compress the waste into a very small region.
Ricky would like whatever Lazarus stroke fountain of youth device Brian uses to keep him so youthful.
Well, that's
something to pick Lego up, because I'm fed up with standing on it. I agree with that. Some kind of Lego magnet would be very, very useful.
This is a good one. Anti-gravity, so I can rise above the argument.
Yes. Thank you very much to our guests, who are Professor Daniel George, Dr. Helen Chersky, and Mr. Russell Kane. You might want to keep quiet about next week's show, as we do plan on telling you how to break the bank at Monte Carlo and improve your Sudoku score. And as this is a Radio 4 show, I imagine most of you are much more excited by the latter rather than the former. So thank you very much for listening. And to play us out, here is the Floppy Drive Orchestra. Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
Turns out we live in a probabilistic universe. What are the chances of that, eh? Actually, never say what are the chances of that in a room full of mathematicians and scientists, because they will work it out for you.
Well, it's 100%. Anyway, if the universe is based on quantum theory and quantum theory is fundamental, then it must be probabilistic.
But is quantum theory fundamental?
Probably.
Exactly.
Anyway, it's too late for Christmas, but today we are looking at the mathematics and psychology of puzzles. How do you beat the banker? How do you come out of the casino with your shirt still on your back? How have puzzles led to mathematical innovations?
So sit down by your baize-covered table, get your cards out and let the games begin, because tonight's panel of poker faces are...
My name is Alex Bellos. I write about maths. My book is Can You Solve My Problems? A Casebook of Ingenious, Perplexing and Totally Satisfying Puzzles. And the game I never lose at is Poo Sticks.
Which is true.
Good one.
My name is Hannah Fry. I'm a mathematician. My latest book is The Indisputable Existence of Santa Claus. And I very rarely play games because they turn me into a bit of a monster.
My name's Helen Zaltzman. I'm a podcaster. I make the podcast Answer Me This and The Allusionist. And the game I never lose is Connect Four, because no one will play me anymore.
I'm Professor Richard Wiseman, psychologist and author of 101 Bets You'll Always Win. And the game I never lose is the Three Knocks game, where you say to a kid at a party, you have to go under a table and remain there while I knock on the table three times. And you knock twice and walk off.
And this is our panel.
Well, I have a question for Alex, because I can't leave it there, because how can you arrange never to lose at Poo Sticks?
Well, because I've only played it once, and I won it. And in fact, now I'm talking about it, it makes my one ever kind of sporting boast, really. I was the Oxford University Poo Sticks champion, because it was the Oxford University Poo Sticks annual event, and I won it.
Was it only one round?
Yeah, not that many people showed up. I wasn't a very popular fresher. But I showed up, I threw my stick in, and got there first.
And you've intentionally never played it again, even with your children or anything like that. You won't play it because you do not want to have that.
The opportunity has not arisen, but I quite like the fact that I've got 100% record.
Mathematically, I'm beginning to lose faith in your statistics in some of your books, if you're prepared to go just the once, but nevertheless.
But the question was, what do I never lose at? And I do never lose at that.
I just don't trust you at all. Richard, I do trust you for... You are very good at confounding people with obscure puzzles. Now, please don't put Brian Cox on the table and say you're going to knock three times. But have you got a challenge for Brian, a puzzle challenge?
I have. Strangely enough, I have. I have a puzzle challenge. Here it is. Here's my bet. I bet I can say 50 words in 60 seconds and not one of them will involve the letter A. Not one of them contains the letter A. 50 words, 60 seconds. Sounds impossible. But you can do it.
Brian, you're very clever. You're a professor, apparently. So,
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700, 800, 900, 1,000. 101, 102, 103, 104, 105, 106, 107, 108, 109, 110, 111, yeah.
Well,
numbers.
That's a solution, very close to the one I had, which is simply to count from 1 to 50. There's no letter A in any of the words from 1 to 50.
Ah. Yeah, I'd worked it out for 10, so I thought I'd give up there. I'm just going 101, 102, 103, but yeah.
So once he said 1,000, though, so that's... He was knocked out at that point.
The lowest number is 101.
Oh, I said 1,000.
Yeah, you said 1,000. So you're right. Through to round two, but Brian, I'm afraid you're just going to have to go home.
I was close, though. It wasn't bad.
I was being very giving. I realised he'd made a mistake, and I thought, you know what, we'll just carry on and pretend that you'd solved the puzzle.
No, there's no way in this show we edit out when he makes a mistake. Desperate bid to make the boy human. So I should find out, because we'll start off on poker. Hannah, you've written books and done lectures which have shown many different ways, quite inscrutable ways of using mathematics to be a victor. In terms of using mathematics, what would be the system that you believe would improve for those people listening now who are poker players?
Well, so ultimately poker is just a game of logic, really. You're playing the probability of you winning against the probability of somebody else winning. So in the very simplest way, what you need to do is work out, based on what card you have at that moment, how many different cards there are left in the pack that could potentially give you a winning hand. It's quite easy to count up those cards. It's called counting outs. Also, based on what's on the table at that time, you can work out what the other players around the table are likely to have in their hands that could potentially beat your hand. So putting those two things together, you can work out your probability of winning. And that's kind of fairly simple to do. That's not too hard to do. The sort of next level to that, if you get, you know, really good at poker, is that you then need to compare that your chances of winning at that moment with what how much money you stand to win in the pot and how much it will cost you to get there, how much you have to bet to leave yourself in the game. And kind of comparing those two odds effectively, the odds of the pot and the odds of you winning at that moment. I mean, then there's sort of so many more levels to that, because that's just if you're playing perfectly rationally and you're just applying the rules of probability and nothing else. But you also want to bluff a little bit. You want to make yourself unpredictable for other players. You want to make yourself unexploitable. And that kind of takes you into whole different areas of game theory, of psychology as well, making sure that you're sort of masking what you're actually doing.
So, Alex, would you say that psychology is more important for the poker player than once you've got the basic mathematical rules, that whole kind of poker face stuff? I mean, that's what I wondered, for instance, is it better to have a poker face, or is it better to be constantly gurning and making just never-ending ridiculous faces every time you get, like kind of Keith Moon drumming or whatever, constant kind of change of faces, so that people just go, well, and also fear for their, you know, their own life, I suppose.
I think that you need the basis of understanding what the numbers are. But after that, it really is, at the top level, more of a game of psychology. I mean, it's not been the case that all the top professors of mathematics have gone on to be poker players at all, although there are lots of great poker players who were great math students.
Richard, can you hide your... Is it possible to just, as Robin said, make such random facial expressions that you can hide everything that happens to you? So you look at your hand... It's a winning hand. Can you always read someone?
No, we're very bad at reading one another. So part of the problem is that we think we're good lie detectors and telling that someone else is lying, and in fact we're pretty terrible. And during a poker game, it's really bad because you're going to want to believe one thing or another. You're going to want to believe your opponent's got a good or a bad hand, and so that's going to mess up your judgment. And also they are going to be quite excited either way. So if they're bluffing, they've got a bad hand, or they've got a good hand, they're going to be sweating and breathing heavily and all those sorts of things that people are excited do. So there's not much you can do. If you do want to cover your lies, you can do what you're sort of talking about there, which is what's called sort of squishing an emotion, where you show a micro-expression for just a few moments of happiness or sadness, and then squish it with a smile or a silly facial expression. It's not such a bad thing to be doing, but you're not going to have many friends by the end of the poker game.
Helen, you were someone, I remember years ago, I'm sure it was spelling games, that you were more a linguistic games person than a numbers games person.
Yeah, well, some letters games like Scrabble are built on mathematical principles, which is why it's not fun. no offence. I used to play a lot of Boggle, because that rewards people that like words and stack them up. But there's not really the same stakes as poker. But if they started introducing that to Vegas casinos, I'd be quite interested, I think.
Who here? You're Radio 4 listeners. Come on. International Boggle for Money. I am imagining this has got to happen.
I want to talk about Monopoly, because I know, Hannah, you've been talking about Monopoly. And actually, today, I'm wandering around seeing people talking about what this was about. And when I said Monopoly, the statistics, the mathematics of Monopoly, everybody went, tell me about that. So... Tell me, because Monopoly seems at first sight like the most random of games. How can you have a strategy in Monopoly?
Well, the trick to winning at Monopoly is noticing that not every square is created equal. Some squares are much more likely to be landed on than others. And the reason for that is because Monopoly has a few curveballs. So throwing three doubles in a row, sending you to jail, the go-to-jail square, the chance and community chess cards that kind of send you off around different places. And what that does is tweak the probability of landing in different places across the board. So once you know that, you can work out your chances of landing in different places and add into that the value of every property to work out what the best possible squares are.
So it is a non-random game,
yeah,
because of things like the jail square.
Exactly.
So the next question then for everyone, I should say we're recording this approaching Christmas. It will be broadcast in January when everyone will be sick of Monopoly. but what So give us a clue then. So given that the jail square is the most likely to land on, which is worthless.
Absolutely right.
How should you use that piece of information?
So because the jail square is the most likely to be landed on, that means that there are the most people leaving the jail square than any other square on the board. And because you're rolling two dice, you're most likely to get a 6, 7, or 8 if you roll two dice. Not every set of numbers that you can roll between 2 and 12 is equally likely. And so that sort of 6, 7, 8 throws, which are very likely, takes you then to the orange set and then round the corner to the red set. And then when you throw again, you end up sort of in red and yellow. So the most likely square, the property that's most likely to be landed on, in the board, taking all of those things into account, is actually Trafalgar Square. Because there's also, I think it's a community chess card which sends you directly there. But the orange set is very well visited as well.
And you should explain why 6, 7, and 8 are the most likely numbers for a two dice throw.
Yeah. So when it comes to throwing two dice, if you think of throwing a two, there's only one possible way that you can throw a two, which is throwing a one on each dice. Whereas if you're throwing a seven, there are several different ways that you can get there. You can have a 3, a 4, a 5, a 2, a 6, and a 1, and so on. And so, just the different combinations of how the dice can be thrown changes the chances of each different total dice roll coming up.
So it's 6, 7, 8. So I can see how you can generate quite a complex pattern going round and round a board. So there's a periodicity to it.
There is, yeah. But if dice rolls were the only thing, then after you'd been round the board a few times, after you kind of the game really got going, actually those probabilities would end up evening out so that every square would be equally likely to be landed on. But it's those curveballs that kind of tweak the probabilities.
I think I read that you said that isn't Park Lane the lowest probability square? So how does that work? Because I couldn't see that immediately.
It's just kind of where it's sitting on the board, really. It doesn't have any squares around it that are sort of, you know, those curveballs that you're being sent to. So the go-to-jail square, for instance, which is just a few before Park Lane, nobody ever ends up landing on there. So that ends up taking up quite a lot of people away from ending up in their next throw landing on Park Lane. So only a 2.1% of throws end up taking you to Park Lane on the board.
Actually, the mathematics of Monopoly. Now, when someone listens to that, might go, why do mathematicians waste time looking at the mathematics of a board game? But I presume that behind all of this is something which we can broaden out in terms of using, looking at life.
I think it's a problem to ask why mathematicians do anything, because you've just got to let the mathematicians do what they do, and even if they do it because it's fun, because they want to be their friends at Monopoly or whatever, because the amount of times that something that a mathematician has discovered that much later has become of fundamental importance to some amazing scientific discovery. So I think that the role of puzzles and games is kind of crucial to inspiring mathematicians to kind of play around with things. And, you know, probably the best example of a puzzle or a game that created a whole new branch of mathematics would be the Bridges of Königsberg puzzle, which was a puzzle in the 18th century, at Königsberg, which has got 7 bridges, and you had to work out, is there a route across all 7 bridges back to the start without going over a bridge twice? And there isn't. And Leonard Euler, who was the kind of the top mathematician of his day, one of the greatest mathematicians ever, in order to prove that you couldn't do it, invented some graph theory, really. He sort of made an abstraction of what was going on, you know, so he, for each side of a bridge, that was a node, and then there was like a line going from node to node across the bridges, and he made what looks now like a kind of a network, and he, with some theorems about how networks work, could prove categorically that you couldn't solve the Bridges of Königsberg problem, and that has become, you know, an extraordinarily rich and vibrant and important field in mathematics. I mean, all the kind of network stuff that we're talking about now wouldn't be around if it wasn't for Leonard Euler, because he was playing some fun game.
So what is graph theory used for today?
Tons of stuff. Yeah. So you can look at how people are connected, sort of social connections. You can look at how diseases spread through populations using it. You can look at the street network. sort of visualizing it through a series of sort of nodes and links rather than actual physical roads. And then you can use that to look at how transport flows, to look at how crime patterns emerge in a city. I mean, just the applications are absolutely endless.
If it is used to do transport flows, because that's exactly what the Bridges of Coedersburg problem was in the first place.
So is that similar to, there's the one when you're a kid, I think it's one of the first, I can't remember this one, it's something like you've got a crocodile and a scorpion and a guinea pig, and the guinea pig, you know, and someone has to get travelled over also with a bag of grain or something. I can't remember, I'm not so hot on the Aesop.
You mean the wolf, the goat and the bunch of cabbages? So there's a traveller, he's been travelling all day, he gets, and he's been travelling with his wolf, his goat and his bunch of cabbages, and he gets to a river. He's got to get to the other side, fantastic, and then he sees there's a boat there, but the boat only has space for himself and one of those items. We've taken the bunch of cabbages is an item. So how does he do it? Because he cannot leave the goat with the cabbages because the goat will eat the cabbages, and he cannot leave the wolf with the goat because the wolf will eat the goat. How does he do it? And this is a puzzle which was first written down in the 8th century, and I would say is probably the most viral in the sense that it's probably spread to more people in the history of civilization than anyone else. But by the 13th century, there's a text that says that every five-year-old in the world can solve this problem, this puzzle. And now it's, you know, it's a logic puzzle. It's one of the very, very first logic puzzles, but it's studied in kind of anthropology and kind of culture because it's become a kind of a folk fable in pretty much every culture in the world. So that is something which, again, we're talking about why do mathematicians play around with puzzles. This is something which has brought so many people to enjoy the process of kind of logical thinking and the enjoyment of actually using your brain, and that's something which should be celebrated.
Richard, is logical thinking difficult for human beings? Is it sort of an alien response to the world, something that has to be learnt,
well,
taught?
I think it is. I mean, I don't think it comes naturally to us. I mean, in this instance, you think, as a psychologist, a man arrives with a wolf, a goat, and some cabbages. I would be thinking, what's going on? Yeah, I wouldn't be thinking, how does he get those across? I'd go, what kind of man is this? That he's he's travelling with a wolf and a goat and some cabbages.
Yeah, but he might have been travelling with his wife originally, and then he kind of screwed up the going across the river the first time, went, the wolf's eating my wife. So it could be that it was a much bigger group initially, and this is what he's left with after going, left the wolf there again. So,
yeah, I think that's a more interesting scenario. I'd quite like to explore that as a psychologist.
Wouldn't they all have eaten each other before they got to the river anyway?
Now we're getting somewhere, you see. But to get back to your question, yes, I don't think we naturally think in these kind of ways. We think sort of emotionally and intuitively. And what's nice about some of these puzzles is they're counterintuitive. You know, the answer is, oh my goodness, it's in front of you all the time or whatever. And that kind of makes it kind of appealing. It's like getting a joke. You suddenly realise you can rearrange the world in your head.
So I think sometimes the difference perhaps between psychologists and mathematicians is a psychologist eventually makes up the answer and mathematicians are determined to get it right. So
there's an element of rigour in mathematics.
Yeah. Unbelievable. He's got a wolf, he's got a goat, he's got some cabbages, and no one's asking the why question. That's all.
It's kind of a cliche that mathematics almost should be, I'm going to say should be useless, but you know what I mean, in a very powerful sense, that there's certainly pure mathematicians, that there doesn't have to be a contact with the real world in terms of usefulness, although, as you've said, time and again, these puzzles lead to useful mathematics. I mean, is that a fair characterization for many mathematicians? It's just in this abstract world of puzzles.
I think so. I mean, traditionally, maths is divided into kind of pure maths, which is that, you know, totally pointless, just playing around with shapes and patterns, and the applied maths, which is, you know, trying to solve problems. But actually, you can't really divide the two, I think, at all. And all mathematicians will be a little bit interested in how what they're doing might apply, but also the want to just have fun. I mean, math is like, it's kind of just like doodling in your brain with ideas just to see where it goes, because you're all the time kind of creating new languages, and it is kind of playful and creative. And I think that that's something that, which is great about puzzles, is that it isolates that aspect of mathematics. And I think that I'm not a professional mathematician, but from what professional mathematicians tell me, the reasons why they do it and they carry on doing it is that there is always that kind of, there's a sort of childlike playfulness the subject always contains.
Yeah, it's the, I mean, I think maths is sort of the ultimate playground, really, the ultimate logical playground.
Is there a character type, Richard, that, that goes into mathematics? Is that a particular?
Are you, where would you even come across a wolf?
Just leave it. Could be a wild boar.
A wild boar's not going to eat a goat.
That's
fine, totally changes the
they're,
plot.
They're vicious wild boar.
It's not going to eat a goat.
Crocodile.
Is it?
A crocodile.
It's more likely to eat the man, isn't
well,
it?
Well, no, you're making it worse. Big, so you're saying it's ridiculous he's got a wolf.
Why
don't
they
a crocodile?
They should have just travelled separately and this would be fine.
You see? I think what's interesting about games, like Monopoly and so on, what I find amazing psychologically is people are so happy when they've won. They kind of go, oh, yes, look at me, like I've won. I've got. And you think, hold on a second. A lot of this had to do with the roll of the dice was chance, or the way you shuffle cards or whatever the game is, chance. You won because of a chance event. But instead of putting anything out there like that, you kind of go, look at me, I won. Disgusting.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, a lot of people say this about the stock market. There's very famous, I don't know if it's true, maybe someone can comment, but there's this famous analysis that said you could throw darts at the FTSE 100 and just invest in that and you would do statistically as well over time as someone who thinks that they're reading patterns in the market.
Oh, we did an experiment years.
But that's a character type, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. We did an experiment years ago where we had a professional investor, we had a financial astrologer that looked at when companies were formed and on the basis of that predicted when to invest in them.
For the radio listeners, that was a very surprised look that he gave us.
And a five-year-old child. And we gave them all £5,000 to invest, and then we tracked them, I think, for 10 days. And the kid outperformed the other two. And we said to the astrologer, are you surprised at the outcome? And she said, no, because the child is Pisces and they're traditionally very lucky.
Helen, is our games, do you think, in the end, the agony for the loser, the frequent frustration, again, as we're saying, this will be going out a few weeks after Christmas, where, you know, family rows over pies in Trivial Pursuit, over, you know, Cluedo, Mastermind, whatever it might be, that actually for the benefit of the limited joy of the victor compared to the agony of the losers says a great deal about humans.
In games like Monopoly, my tactic is usually get into jail as soon as possible, sit out the rest of the game in there, because it is not fun. That is a game that rewards people that are very into admin and buying a lot of houses and ruining everyone else's lives, and that is too close to reality.
No, I think that in terms of game playing, I think Helen's exactly right. It should be as much fun as possible. For me as a psychologist, it's about bonding. I mean, you don't want to sit around at Christmas or whenever and just alienate everyone else around the table as you go, yes, I won. You think, well, what kind of achievement is that? You know, so these should be about having fun. That just seems to me the key thing. And my mathematician colleagues, much as I respect them, have taken away a lot of that fun. I've got a mathematical puzzle. Here's a quick, which was ruined for me by another mathematician, actually. Here's the puzzle. You say to people, give me any three-digit number, and within 10 seconds, I'll multiply that number by 7, then 11, and then 13. And that sounds quite good.
So what do I have to do? Give you three?
Any three-digit number, and within 10 seconds, I'll multiply it by 7, 11, and 13 in my head.
399.
Sorry, 399. The answer is 399, 399. Because 7 times 11 times 13 is 1,001, and any number times 1,001 is itself repeated. I thank you.
I use that because I go to schools quite a lot. And
how much do you
earn? So I was quite disappointed not to hear a wow. When you do that to 400 15-year-olds, you get a wow. You really get a feeling of excitement. And that's kind of nice to think that I'm here talking about mathematics and they're kind of as excited as they would, you know, watching a magician or
Those patterns in numbers are quite fascinating, aren't they?
Yeah.
And then you get the really deep questions about patterns in the prime numbers, for example.
Well, those are three prime numbers, so the prime factors of 1,001 are 7, 11, and 13.
Helen, what for you are the most exciting ideas, again, for kind of luring people into the world of puzzling and mathematics and problem solving?
You take the goat across first, and then the wolf, but then you take the goat back with you, then the cabbages across to where the wolf is, and then the goat is the last trip.
is the right answer.
That is...
I don't accept that.
What, you don't accept the system of going across?
No, because
the...
wolves eat cabbages.
Do? Again, I'm not entirely sure. Do Scott
eat cabbages? Wolves as well,
eat cabbages. Wolves
everybody
eat knows cabbages.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not the right, yeah. Google wolves, cabbages. I think we'll know where we'll end up with that one.
They, right, do it. So you're always
going to do it. Wolves, cabbages. Carry on.
Right, go on.
Wolves are merely opportunistic carnivores. When there's a when there's a shortage of game, they can survive a short while with a vegetarian diet.
Right.
There we go.
Did it?
The ill-posed problem, which neglected the possibility that a wolf can be a temporary vegetarian.
Right. Okay, then, so it turns out your brilliant problem for 1,200 years has been a waste of everyone's time. And it's going to turn out there are 8 bloody bridges at Cunnersberg as well, isn't it?
So that wouldn't make any difference, would it, if there were 8?
It all depends on what rivers they were going across.
Ah.
If there was a bridge...
Oh, you bring that up now?
Well, the reason why they're bridges is because it's lots of little islands, like with bridges across the rivers. It depends where the rivers are going.
Oh, yeah, because you had 2 onto one island.
Yes.
Right, I think what we've discovered is puzzles really aren't as simple as they might at first appear. When given a puzzle, ask a lot of questions about the dietary requirement of the animals involved, how many wives the man has, etc. Was it a Mormon man with a wolf?
Was it a motorway bridge or a river bridge? There's a lot of parameters you did not establish at the start, which I think is unfair.
Richard, what is it about the psychology of people that when they can't solve the puzzle, always want to change the question?
So anyway, we asked the audience a question, and the question was, there's a wolf, there's some cabbages.
Puzzles are fun, aren't they? Aren't they fun?
So we asked the audience a question was, what game do you think you could beat Brian Cox at, and why? So the answers include...
Here's one, the replicant test from Blade Runner, because I'm human. And that's from Robin Ince.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that. Cluedo, because you can always find Professor Cox in the observatory with a telescope. Russian roulette. Oh, my goodness.
Russian roulette.
Yeah, either way, one of us won't care who won. Don't worry, Brian, Elizabeth will be placed on the list. So thank you very much to our guests, who have been Dr. Hannah Fry, Professor Richard Wiseman, Alex Bellos, and Helen Zaltzman. We're going to now set you some homework. Richard Wiseman, you have a problem set, I believe.
I do indeed. You meet a person in the street, you find out that person has 2 children and one of them is a boy. What are the chances that the other one is a boy?
Well, we will tell you that next week. Brian, have you worked it out yet? Still thinking about cabbages. Okay, then. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
In the infinite monkey game.
Without your trousers.
In the infinite monkey game.
Turn that nice again.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox. Today we're going to do something unusual on Monkey Cage and not deliver a fatuous and juvenile introduction that runs the risk of trivialising science.
Which is a pity.
That's because virtually every politician is performing that service admirably. 2017 looks set to be the year of the people who know they are right, the year in which, with jowly certitude, feelings are elevated beyond evidence. But science is the enemy of the certain. To paraphrase the Nobel Prize winning physicist Richard Feynman, the scientist has a lot of experience with ignorance and doubt and uncertainty, and this experience is of very great importance. When a scientist doesn't know the answer to a problem, they are ignorant. When they have a hunch as to what the result is, they are uncertain. And when they are pretty darn sure of what the result is going to be, they are still in some doubt. Science, Feynman concludes, is a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance, a way of thinking in which doubt is not to be feared, but welcomed and discussed. So, in celebration of the great value of getting things wrong, today we'll explore science's epic fails and how they lead to a deeper understanding of nature.
Or, to paraphrase it, it's going to be called, yeah, even Professor Brian Cox is wrong, actually. And it is true. I saw him say millions when he meant billions the other day, and he looked like a right idiot. Anyway... You did. You were mocked mercilessly by that group from the Royal Society. So we are joined.
It's very
and when
different.
They mock with a powdered wig, whoa.
There's no difference in cosmology. Millions, billions, trillions, no difference. It's a lot. How many stars are in the universe?
The universe has existed for a lot of time. That just, you wouldn't be selling the shows abroad with that kind of thing. So, we are joined by a panel of experts, or at least people who appear to be experts. So, they are...
I'm Dr. Adam Rutherford, and I'm a geneticist and writer and broadcaster. And the idea I'd most like to be scientifically verified, I think, is... time travel, so maybe we could just rerun 2016. Maybe have Bowie back, you know, just for a bit. That'd be all right?
No, nonsense, it won't work.
I'm...
I'm just pointing out that time travelling to the past is not possible as far as we understand.
Well, then I'm going to be wrong about it, but that's the whole point of this show, isn't it?
Boom!
Thanks, Rufus.
I'm Professor Alice Roberts. I'm an anatomist, author and broadcaster. I'm based at the University of Birmingham, and I would like it to be proven that there would be a simple genetic switch that we could somehow change and humans could recover their gills and be able to breathe underwater equally as well as breathing in air.
No, that's nonsense as well.
Now, let's see if Brian can get the full hat trick and crush the dreams of our final guest.
My name's Rufus Hound. I do all your common or garden flavours of showing off. And the theory I would most like to be true is Everettian infinite kind of possibility. The idea that every choice, both choices are made, and all we are is the end of the current branch, but that those realities are permanently fracturing, and that those realities are as closer to us than our own atoms, and that you might be able to prize our reality open and step into a different reality. Because rather than turning back the clock or breathing underwater, it would just be nice to find somewhere that was going better than this.
And that is the only one that has an even tiny, tiny, infinitesimally small chance of being right. In fact, it probably is right. The many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics.
And this is our panel! Can I say, Rufus, that was very impressive. That delivery there shows why you were on the Just a Minute Christmas special. There was almost no, the little bit of hesitation, but the deviation, not at all. At least not in this particular universe. So we will start off with you, Rufus, which is, in some ways, what we're looking at tonight, I suppose, is reflecting on this idea, 2016, the new phrase of a post-fact world. Why do you think it is that we seem to have an increasingly large group of people who are not keen on kind of an evidence-based world?
Because we would all rather have the comforting lie than the cold, ugly truth. And that is all it boils down to. It's easier to appeal to people's feelings than it is to ask people to consider facts.
I think the real reason is we don't teach it. We don't teach uncertainty. We don't teach how we know. It is inherent to science, as the Feynman quote that Brian was reading at the beginning, that we have doubts and we have the ability to change our minds. And I think the true mark of a good scientist is one that changes his or her mind.
Well done. Yeah.
Well, I almost said it's mind.
To be honest, sometimes I do see scientists as it's a scientist.
But we don't teach it. We don't teach it at school. It should be the absolute bedrock of what we teach children about how we know stuff.
It's not only that we don't teach that, it's that we actively teach the exact opposite of that.
Yes.
Which is that if you're in a class and you get a bad grade, you have failed. And how does that make you feel? It makes you feel sad and upset with yourself, and now you know that you are a failing person. So all we are taught about failure is how terrible it is. Not the one thing that really came to the forefront of my mind when I was asked to be here was, is it Benjamin Franklin's quote of, who invented the light bulb?
I'm very impressed by this. We've done Just a Minute and now we're on quote unquote. This is going to be a medley of all of them.
Who was it? Franklin's Edison.
Edison. Edison. I think it was Edison.
He was one of them.
There were
a lot of light bulb inventions at the same time.
Who said, I didn't fail at inventing the light bulb. I successfully proved 99 ways not to do it. Until I eventually found the one. That sort of underpins absolutely all science.
Until Edison, no one could have ideas. Because there was nothing to appear above your head. So it was...
do you think it's an unnatural way of being? Because it's certainly, as you said, central to the to a scientific education, that being wrong is the means by which we learn. Right. It is, and I think genuinely, I think about this. I know we were talking about earlier that I'm delighted when I'm wrong in science, because it means that I then know more about nature. And it's I mean, you kind of laugh. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But I think that's a central part of the scientific training, certainly in research.
I don't think it's unnatural. I think it's about retaining a kind of childlike sense of playing with the world and accepting that some of the things you think about the world will change, will turn out to be wrong, and that you need to preserve that into adulthood.
Well, it's also the most important part of the development of a scientific idea. So when you take the laws or the theories that have really stood the test of time, that's why they're the most robust form of an idea, not just in the sciences, but in all domains, in all intellectual domains. So you take something like evolution by natural selection. Scientists have been spending 160 years trying to prove that wrong. And there have been details within what Darwin initially described which were wrong, which were fantastically wrong or amusingly wrong. But the central idea remains the same, despite the fact that people have been trying to prove it wrong for more than 1.5 centuries. And that's why it's a good idea, and that's what the scientific method delivers. It delivers robust ideas that are testable and subject to being wrong, but the good ones survive that.
There's an interesting example, actually, evolution, because you have Darwin, you also have the competing ideas at the time, Lamarck, I'm thinking about as well. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about that, those different views of the way that organisms become complex, if you like, or the tree of life branches, but then also how those ideas can come back into fashion again.
So Darwin and Lamarck before him were both operating in a time when people didn't understand how traits were acquired or inherited. So they didn't really understand how particular characteristics of an organism could be passed on to offspring. And it would be a long time before genetics came to the fore and we started to understand that. So Lamarck suggested that actually traits that were acquired during a lifetime could be passed on to offspring. So for instance, if a giraffe was trying really hard to reach branches higher up to get those leaves and grew a longer neck during its lifetime, then that could be passed on to its offspring. And the strong arms of
a blacksmith,
thank you very much, could again be passed on to the blacksmith's offspring, which I think now seems extraordinary to us, because there's a distinction between characteristics that you acquire during your lifetime and characteristics that are there in your genes, and those are the characteristics that you pass on to your offspring. But actually Darwin believed in soft inheritance as well. So, you know, we celebrate him for being right about natural selection, but as Adam said, he was wrong about a lot of things, and he didn't understand inheritance, and he made room for soft inheritance, the idea that acquired characteristics could be passed from one generation to the next.
I should say, it's not surprising at the time, though, because the mechanism by which information is passed from generation to generation was 100 years away.
Yeah,
at that time, 1860s.
Darwin also thought that there would be a blending of characteristics mm-hmm. between the parents as well. He absolutely didn't understand that there were units of inheritance, which we now know to be genes. But having said all of that, you know, we have to be careful about dogma, because we've got this interesting theory of epigenetics, which has arrived in the last few years, which is still very contentious. But it raises the possibility of at least some level of acquired characteristics being passed from one generation to the next.
I should say, for the radio listeners, I should say that I don't know how to describe Adam Rutherford's face when epigenetics was mentioned, but it was kind of a strange contorted.
I'd like a stab at it. Imagine. Imagine going for a wee in the woods and accidentally brushing a nettle.
And not with your arm.
Well, because then you'd have to pass on the slightly swollen arm to your children and their children.
So epigenetics breaks down into two things, actually, and it's basically the fact that around the DNA there are other molecules which become modified, and that affects whether genes are expressed or not, which makes a lot of difference to a cell. The more controversial aspect of it is that some of those modifications around the genes are possibly heritable, which means that things that happen to you during your lifetime could be passed on to your children without a change in the DNA itself. So there's an interesting experiment with either rats or mice being exposed to the smell of acetophenone, which apparently smells of cherry blossom, and being electrocuted at the same time. Nasty experiment. And then the offspring of those rodents apparently expressed fear when they smelled the same cherry blossom smell. And in fact, the offspring of those offspring as well.
Mm. But you're dubious about something. It. Mm. That explains, my mouse won't go to Chekhov with me. Now, I've always wondered why. I inherited it from my mad scientist uncle. Now everything makes sense.
Radio 4 joke.
Oh, come on, Chekhov, very mainstream, love.
But it has to, traits have to be permanently transmissible from one generation to the next in order for natural selection to act upon them. And there is no evidence for that in mice or humans or almost all eukaryotes. So we're at a stage where we're looking at something which doesn't look right, isn't supported by the evidence, and we can't have, we don't have a mechanism for it. So that's the point where I sort of begin to lose interest in this hype.
It's like string theory, isn't it, Brian?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it reminds me more of Fred Hoyle, the cosmologist who many people think should have got the Nobel Prize for showing or proposing that heavy elements are cooked in the hearts of stars, so nuclear synthesis. He didn't get the Nobel Prize, and some people speculate the reason for that is he supported a different theory of cosmology called the steady-state theory of cosmology, which is the idea that as the universe expands, new matter is created. So that means that you can have an eternal universe that's expanding, but there's a key prediction that the universe will always look the same. So if you look out to distant galaxies 10 billion light years away, you would see a universe that looks exactly the same as it does today. So you can have an eternal universe. And the reason that's interesting from what Adam said is that I look back in the 1970s, just after we discovered the afterglow of the Big Bang, the so-called cosmic microwave background radiation, a very famous physicist, Steven Weinberg, said that the steady state theory is a good theory. It is a great theory. It is most likely wrong. We now know it is wrong as far as we can tell. But in the 1970s, it was looking like it was going to be wrong. But the reason he defined it as a good theory is because it made very specific predictions which could be tested. In this case, that if you look out to the most distant objects you see a universe, you're looking back in time, you see a universe that looks exactly the same as it does today. And we know that the universe doesn't look exactly the same if you look out to great distances and therefore back to the earlier times, 13 billion years ago or so. So in that sense, I suppose, is that what you mean by a good theory? You described things you're not interested in. Do you mean really theories that don't make predictions? And so the flip side of that is that you have a theory that can be shown to be wrong, but if it makes specific predictions you can test, it is good even though we find out it is wrong.
More prosaic examples than the steady state. A couple of years ago, you remember there was a big hoo-ha about a publication of a paper which suggested that neutrinos travelled faster than light. Now, this was top quality science because what the researchers in Italy did is say, we've got two possible outcomes here. Either pretty much everything we know about physics is wrong, or we're wrong. And so they opened it out and they released the data and they said, we can't find out what's wrong with it. You guys go and do it. And you guys did go and do it. And it turned out it was a loose wire at some point. Now, that is the strength of science. That's the strength of science to say, here's a result which we don't understand. We think it's probably wrong. You go and work out what it is. And, you know, they were right. They were wrong.
It's a key point. You publish it. Another very good example is a friend of mine, Brian Schmidt, who discovered, as a postdoc, he discovered that the universe appeared to be accelerating in its expansion by looking at the light from distant supernova explosions. And that at the time, he felt that that was nonsense, that it couldn't have been right. And he tried everything. And he said to me that eventually he thought, I cannot see what I've done wrong, so I'll publish it, and I probably will not get a job, I will not get hired, that's the end of my scientific career, but I'm honest as a scientist, I will publish it and let others tell me where I went wrong. He got the Nobel Prize because he was right, and that measurement was confirmed by the next group that looked at it. But it's that honesty, and that's the key point, isn't it? Mm. It's about intellectual honesty. I this may well be wrong, but I'm going to publish it because if it's shown to be wrong, we have learned something as a community about nature.
We mentioned Fred Hoyle, and I don't want to get too far away from you. So some people I was talking to earlier said, oh, well, he was a bad scientist. But how do we define, you know, as someone who could have won the Nobel Prize, How do you feel, Rufus, about the idea of someone, do they become a bad scientist, or do they merely have some areas of their knowledge where they're into bad science? There is things that we would consider to be bad science.
I'm going to see if I can make Brian's head explode with this sentence. Of course, science is really just a branch of philosophy.
Especially physics.
Especially physics, yeah.
That's why they sound alike.
It's philosophy with fact.
Yeah. No, well, I say that to make Brian's head explode. I don't actually mean it.
But no, you should mean it.
But what I do mean is to test anything like the nature of the universe or the physical world around us, you have to start with the idea. And therefore, there has to be an idea in place. Or you have to have read about somebody else's idea or somebody else's theory or somebody else's proof. Then have an idea yourself about how that could be tested. So there is a feat of imagination at play throughout everything that science offers. And, as a fan of science fiction, there will be no short of Star Trek fans who will say, of course, the only reason we even have mobile phones is because there were communicators in Star Trek. A whole generation of kids grew up going, wouldn't that be cool? And generation upon generation built themselves closer to the point where they were like, I'm going to make this happen. We're going to have communicators. This is going to be amazing, guys. And the reason that I think we will end up with laser guns is, because of Star Wars. It starts as a feat of imagination, and then what is known and what is practical is applied to the idea. He's not a bad scientist because he clung... He was stubborn, but human. That doesn't make you a bad scientist. Doing science badly makes you a bad scientist, I think.